It's Tuesday morning, so we're starting with our week's program. Members, of course, we will today continue with our deliberations on the Critical Infrastructure Protection Bill. Maybe just before that, we distributed a copy of the draft program, the updated one, just to alert members. Today we will, of course, deliberate. Tomorrow we also continue with that process. Next week, we will have SAPS, the Social Justice Coalition, SAPU and POPCRU, on the issue of the fixed establishment at stations. Members will remember the petition that we received last year outside Parliament, so that is next week. Then the DPCI must come to us on all the high-profile investigations, state capture, but also the issue of human trafficking, drugs unit, upgrade and firearms. Maybe just to indicate that the Portfolio Committee on Women in the Presidency indicated that they also want to be present when we discuss the issue of human trafficking, so I said they are very much welcome to be part of that process. Then Tuesday the 6th, the vetting issue again on the table, and also the quarterly reports of crime stats, Stats SA and the crime researchers, to look at that process. Then the technology of SAPS, the issues, the BRRR recommendations, they must come to us on the 7th of March. Then IPIT must come to us on the 13th of March to look at, well, not legislation, but also our standing committee reports. Then in March, we slotted 2 days again for this protection bill. Hopefully we'll have consensus by then, but we'll see how it goes. And then on the 20th of March, CIRA, on matters in the public domain. And at this stage, we've slotted in clause by clause on the 22nd. But of course, if we make good progress, you know, we can make that earlier, but then we want to adopt on the 27th, then IPET on the 28th, and also the Marikana investigations, and the DPCI judge and the DAN board. But of course, if there's other issues coming up, of course, we will also slot them in. So members, that is just a draft for your notice. Members, then, On Mulhlongo wrote to me last week, and he just wanted to raise a matter. He's welcome, On Mulhlongo.
No, thank you very much, honourable members and members of SABS. No, Chairperson, it's quite true. I wrote to our Chairperson because, members will recall that in our, almost, I think, our last meeting, we were briefed about the report of women, of one of the members who is a female who was abused within the SAPS, who's a member. From there, from that discussion, because members of the public caught it up as it gets televised on the parliamentary system, one happened to be flooded with a number of grievances, particularly from female members who were complaining of various things, some of them which are rather very serious, including them soliciting promotion through sexual exchanges and all these things. And some of them actually then even considering committing suicide because of the load of kind of harassment they are faced with within male members within the service. It is in that context that I had to alert the Chairperson that under the given circumstances, when we are seeking ways of professionalizing our SAPS to be in line with the international standards and all that, and also to be in line with our constitutional dictates, maybe it will be prudent for us to create a platform for women members to feel comfortable to raise these issues, knowing that they are not going to face reprisals from their seniors who are harassing them. Because to me, it became very clear that Some of them are scared because they are scared either of losing their jobs or losing promotions or some benefits within the service. Then it was in that particular context that I had to alert our chairperson to say, maybe it will be prudent to even engage the ministry in the presidency of women so that they can actually then give us or share with us some ideas. How best can we harness and deal with this particular thing so that those people who are involved or who are predating on our women members must be exposed and dealt not only what, for example, what General Mgwenga was saying, that no, they have been dismissed. But I think members of the public they will hardly know that, and even the victims, because here you are dealing with members of the service, and some people, you will find that even if a member has got a legitimate grievance, is scared that I might be silenced at gunpoint, even only if I happen to air this. Now, if without us creating a user-friendly environment for women within the service to air these things voluntarily so that males can also be educated, taken on a path of or a learning curve, to understand that women who are there in the service are not just there for them to prey on. They are there to actually improve service delivery, which we need the most, because at the end of the day, we look upon South African Police Service to enforce DVA. How can South African Police Service enforce DVA even only if they themselves actually then are harassing their own women colleagues? Then it's a serious contradiction and a conundrum that needs to be dealt with very vigorously without us failing, particularly as public representatives and all of us. Because there are good men and women within our members of the service, but who get tainted by those people who are doing these criminal activities, because it's a criminal thing to actually then suppress a colleague on the basis that she is a woman, or even solicit some favors in exchange of things like even ranking and all these things. If we can have that thing as one, for example, one woman who is in Johannesburg, has written to me a very long dossier, which I think the chairperson has actually also read. That thing is actually quite astonishing. If you read through that, you feel like crying, really. Because then you can't believe that another human being can do that to another person. And you expect that particular person, when they engage in a particular crossfire with the criminals, for that particular officer to defend her own colleague. How can she actually defend the criminal who is actually predating on it? Then this, it is in that particular light and that particular context, ladies and gentlemen, I said, what kind of a mechanism can we build in as an oversight in order to ensure that women members can feel free to raise these issues without any fear of any kind of reprisal, without those people using their seniority to suppress the will of the people or the feelings of other people within the service, yet doing very, very wrong things. And that particular example of that woman, particularly in Kwamashu, if you can read what has been happening, it was good because it was raised by another male police officer who was fed up of what was happening, because that woman is now like a slave within the service who can't say a word because the senior, the commanding senior, is actually then abusing her as much as he likes. He is just like a toy of that man who wants to distress his own stress on that particular woman. Very, very, very bad and ugly. Thank you very much, Chairperson, for that opportunity.
Thank you, Honorable Songo. I think what we will do, we will take that matter to the MANCO and maybe look at our program and then have a joint meeting with the Committee on Women in the Presidency to deal with that and also invite SAPS. But thank you for raising that issue with us. I also got further complaints after that specific, the last meeting. So if members also receive complaints, please forward it to us that we can also process that. Thank you very much. Members, then we go to the business of the day. Yes, yes.
We had a gender violence
Yeah.
Has been taken yeah. off the program, but that would speak, I think, to what we're discussing.
I think we plan it, but due to the legislative pressures, we're going to take that to the second term. So that will still happen. That will still happen.
I want to respond.
Yeah. Thank you. Members, thank you very much. In terms of our program of this morning, we will have a short briefing from the department on some of the issues that was raised at the last meeting. And after that, members, what we will do, we will then use the document that was provided by the research on the 12th of February, where we will go through the different presentations and issues that was raised, and then we're going to see, is there consensus on some of the issues? What issues do we still flag as contentious? Where do we need more clarification? And that's going to be the approach. But I'm going to first ask the honourable members to introduce themselves, and then we'll go to ask also the different delegations to introduce themselves.
So before we move on, could I just go back to your schedule there?
The program, yes.
The program. It says Tuesday, 22nd of March. 22nd of March is Thursday. And the days are all wrong from then down. So perhaps that could be an update.
Yeah, remember those last 2 weeks are committee weeks. So okay, no, let's ask the secretary just to...
Okay.
Thanks for that, honourable member.
Sorry, let's Hello.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning. Zakhele Mbele, member of the committee.
Goeiemôre, dames en heren. My name is Angie Muliwadi. Ek is al lid van hierdie komitee en ek dank u.
Good morning, Mabijari Buhane, a member of this committee.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning. My name is Cindy Lemola, a member of this portfolio committee. I thank you.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Philip Busong, a member of the committee.
Thank you very much, Ms. Brigadier van Valk.
Thank you, Chair, honourable members. I'm Brigadier Bas van Valk from SAPS Legal Services.
Good morning, Chair. Good morning, honourable members. I'm Dawn Bauer from the Civilian Secretariat for Police, part of the drafting team.
Good morning, honourable members, Chairperson. My name is Alvin Pumunzo-Rapeya, Secretary for Police Service.
Good morning, Chair and honourable members. My name is Milton Twana. I'm from the Civilian Secretariat for Police Service Legislation Unit.
Good morning, Chairperson and honourable members. My name is Natim Jengwane. I'm a parliamentary legal advisor. Thank you.
Morning, Chair. Morning, honourable members. My name is Sisa Makabeni. I'm the office of the Chief State Law Advisor.
Okay. Good morning, Chairperson and honourable members. I am Tumile Sali from APCOF.
Thank you very much. Let's start in with the first item, the briefing with relation to last week's comments. Over to the department.
Thank you, Chairperson. I was designated to do this presentation. The purpose of the presentation is to give attention to three areas the committee highlighted at the previous occasion. Firstly, the role and responsibility of the Private Security Industry Authority in terms of the PSIR Act, especially in view of clauses 24 and 25 of the bill, which deals with the powers of the person in control and also access control, as well as the APCOF submission on that subject. The second focus area will be the offences in clause 26 of the bill. Third focus area will be the role and responsibility of Parliament in the promulgation of regulations under clause 27 of the bill. With regard to the first focus area, Chair and honourable members, in the bill itself, when we refer to clauses 24 and 25, the phrases security personnel or security service provider are used frequently. When one has regard to the definitions of these two phrases in clause 1, security personnel means any person registered as a security officer in terms of section 21 of the PSIR Act, and the security service provider means a security service provider as defined in Section 1 of the PSIR Act. So it goes without saying wherever these words appear in the bill, it automatically means that these persons are registered and fall under the PSIR Act, and that a person who, for instance, is not registered will not be regarded as a security officer or a security service provider. It is therefore obviously compulsory for the security personnel referred to the CIP bill, firstly, registration with CIRA, and secondly, more importantly, the compliance with the Code of Conduct for Security Service Providers, 2003, and then, of course, the misconduct 2006, etc. With regards to the presentation of APCOF, I think it's an important aspect that was highlighted, was the concern about the powers of security personnel. COSATU had the same issue with strip searches and humiliation of workers that was pointed out by the presenter. What is important in this bill, however, Chair, is the fact that there are no explicit powers of arrest, detention or dispersal in terms of the Critical Infrastructure Protection Bill. So the powers that will be performed, or the functions that will be performed, will only be only those contained in Chapter 2 of the Criminal Procedure Act, and those will be only for civilian persons. In other words, there are no additional powers in terms of arrest, detention or dispersal. Only powers to search are extended somewhat in the Critical Infrastructure Protection Bill, and the Department is of the view that those powers are fairly limited and also described. The regulations also will provide for specific limits to those powers. So if the security personnel go beyond the explicit powers in the CIP bill, it's a violation of the CIRA Code of Conduct. So I think the main issue here with that was highlighted by APCOF, for instance, with security guards doing crowd management. This is a conduct problem rather than an issue with the powers that are assigned to the security officers in the bill. So we are therefore of the opinion that this is one area that cannot be catered for in the bill because it's adequately catered for in other legislation that pertains to security officers. What we do propose, Chairperson, is that we formulate somewhere in the Critical Infrastructure Protection Bill so that it states clearly that a person to whom functions are assigned in terms of that chapter, clause 24, 25, 26, must exercise those powers and perform such duties subject to the Constitution and with due regard to the fundamental rights of every person, so that it's very clear. There's a similar provision in the Police Act, and it will be made very clear that people may be held accountable for their actions if they do overstep the boundaries of their functions. And then secondly, with regard to the searches, in the search provision in the bill, reference will be made to Section 29 of the Criminal Procedure Act as proposed by the research unit, so that the section is also applicable to all searches under the Act or under the CIP bill. With regards to the second focus area, Chairperson, the offences in Clause 26, I think the presentations that were made to the committee were very, very well researched and had some very good suggestions in that. And we certainly took note of that. It will be proposed to the committee during the clause-by-clause deliberations that the Clause 26, as it presently is in the bill, be reviewed in its entirety, and that the drastic maximum penalties are reduced to reflect the severity of the offence proportionally. Chairperson, how we propose that we go about this is firstly to remove clause 26.1. And this is the clause that elicited the most response in terms of the maximum sentence of 30 years. But we remove this offense in its entirety, as the offense is already covered in the Criminal Matters Amendment Act sufficiently. That act deals with destruction, damage to tampering with essential infrastructure, which is not to be confused with this. It's the so-called cable theft legislation. But we are of the view that the Criminal Matters Amendment Act sufficiently provides for this type of situation that we previously tried to cover in the bill. Secondly, Jay, with the offences and the disclosure of information and photographs, we will propose during the clause-by-clause deliberations that the focus be on security measures related to the critical infrastructure, so that the typical selfie in front of Parliament does not constitute. As the offence was drafted initially, we remain of the opinion that the drafting tried to exclude as much of the typical negligent or selfie offences, but hopefully with a redraft we will come closer to that purpose of focusing only on the security measures. We will also propose during the deliberations, Chair, that we insert a clause I may just mention the penalties will be brought down drastically for that first offence, entering, taking photographs, etc., etc. So those penalties will really, I think we were talking about 3 years maximum. But then there will be a clause inserted where evidence of intention to do damage will increase the maximum penalty relative to the risk category also of the critical infrastructure. So when you sit with a low risk, for instance, the parliamentary precincts, that the increased penalty reflects the fact that it's a low risk critical infrastructure. And where you move towards the Coburg type of situation, that those penalties be increased also relative to the risk category of that infrastructure. Secondly, Chair, to insert a clause, and I think this also comes from one of the suggestions by the persons who commented, to insert a clause where the actual harm caused by the offence will also increase the maximum penalty and also relative to the risk category of the critical infrastructure. I think that's an important move towards a more just and equitable situation, and those will certainly be proposed. Then, furthermore, it's necessary to, in our view, to insert a clause in view of all the submissions where a court may have regard to evidence that the security measures, which are in plain view of the public or in the public domain, if those are disclosed, that it will certainly be a mitigating factor when a person is accused in court of, for instance, taking photographs of security measures. I think this will also go a long way to ease the concerns of the commentators. However, I think it's important for the committee to keep in mind the overriding government objective of securing critical infrastructure remains important, so that we cannot just do away with this type of offence, that there must be some form of penalty involved for persons who really overstep the boundaries. Then the third focus area, Chairperson, was with regard to the regulations, and I apologize in advance for presenting a watered-down lecture, and the words in this portion comes mostly from statute law and interpretation by Professor Alan du Plessis of Stellenbosch in the Law of South Africa. Law states that there is a clear distinction between original and delegated legislation. This isn't news. That Acts of Parliament is often in skeleton form while the flesh is added by the delegated legislation. And an important comment there is that not all legislative matters have to be dealt with and deliberated upon by elected representatives, as the executive is often in a better position to deal with certain matters once the parameters within which it is competent for them to do so have been set by empowering regional legislation. So there is a framework to say, here are your powers, this is what you must do, and the delegated legislation will then continue to say how it must be done. So regulations, therefore, as is obviously known, Chairperson, therefore owe its existence and its authority to the empowering regional legislation. The capacity to make this delegated legislation rests in the executive and may be viewed as administrative action that may be set aside by a court if found to be ultra vires the empowering statutes. So if there's something that's unconstitutional in the regulations, it's not necessary to go to the Constitutional Court. It can be set aside as an administrative action. I think this is an important progress from pre-94 that the Constitution brought. Then lastly, Section 17 of the Interpretation Act requires that a list of delegated legislation be submitted to Parliament within 14 days after publication, which is the reason why the bill in its current format makes provision for tabling in Parliament for noting. And that's in clause 27.5. In terms of the current legal situation, this is a courtesy extended to Parliament by the Executive, but also, importantly, an acknowledgement of the important role of Parliament. However, when Parliament considers regulations before promulgation, it may be seen as usurping the role of the Executive, firstly, but secondly, the regulations could just as well be contained in the empowering statute if Parliament is to consider the regulations, because then it has the same process as law. Thank you. I just need to add to the last thought. This is obviously within the power of the committee to decide that regulations must be brought to the committee or to Parliament before promulgation, which is not, I think, the drafting team finds it neither here nor there, because this is in the power of the committee to decide. I think what we try to show with this presentation was just what the legal situation is normally in terms of the regulations. So thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Brigadier. I think the drafting team made a lot of progress. I think, especially on the issue of the penalty clauses, I think there's huge progress, and I think that will take us a long way forward. Let's go to the members for further questions. First, Honourable Galabana, then Honourable Mklungu, Honourable Bele.
I've got two queries. One is about your private security and their mandate at a building, which they're now hired to protect, but in fact can't really protect because they're not allowed to do anything. In stating that they may not arrest, detain, or basically touch anybody except for a possible search situation if they... Let's say someone sets off a detector and then they search and find a firearm. That sort of search is what I'm imagining. What do they do if protesters invade the building? Do they simply stand back against the wall and let them go in and smash the place up and wait and hope the police find the time to arrive? What is the status once that barrier has been breached? That I'm not clear on. The other question, I just have the two, the regulations. I think it's critical that they come here from our perspective, because if one looks at certain regulations, things are being snuck into regulations that committees have been very fiercely against. But I'm also seeing, for example, the proposal that the majority holding of foreign-owned private security companies be taken, simply taken over. That never really went through. However, if one goes to Home Affairs, you find, or I have found, that now declared as undesirables are exotic dancers, hairdressers, and anyone involved in any private security company. They are undesirable. They may not come here. They may not live here. So if they want to run a company or are promoted by an overseas company to be a manager of a company here, they're not allowed in the country. So basically, we have, through that way, because they were foiled by this committee, they went another route, and that way there can be no more foreign investment in this country in this regard. So I just think it's not quite as simple as one might imagine. Thank you.
Remember, Honorable Mshlungu?
What I wanted to find out, particularly when it comes to the areas of penal, because noting the changing environment we live in, particularly on high sensitive security areas, I wonder, Chairperson, if maybe we can also or whether then this will be covered under the, I'm looking at the flying objects, for example. Today you have got some powerful people who some own even these private drones who can use them for whatever forms of surveillance in order to extract very, very sensitive information, particularly that relates to security of the state in high sensitive areas. Under such circumstances, well, do we have maybe a clause that deals with this? I'm raising this particularly, Chairperson, because I think he in this naval base here of Cape Town, to me, I don't know whether it was in the naval base of Cape Town or Cooper, whereby a private drone just fell on the ground in one way, in one form or the other, but then one could not get the details as to the question of ownership of that one, what was it doing there, why was it flying over such a high sensitive area of high security and all these other areas, and also the question of punishment of such. Because even only if we can just think about ordinary people breaking or ordinary breaches of law, of security, forgetting about these high-tech vultures who are actually running interstate kind of gathering of information, then we can actually then be dealing with the victims already, yet those who are on top of the hill are just actually doing as much as they like, breaking away with murder. So I was just looking at that particular clause, or maybe we can tailor it in or refer to a particular legislation that will enable other, maybe, organs of state to take over that particular area rather than just keeping quiet on it, because I think it will actually call for members of security forces to just simply keep on passing the buck without any particular organ taking full responsibility to say such breach has taken place. If the buck stops with us to actually execute this kind of investigation or taking the matter forward. Thanks.
Thank you, Honorable Mshlungu, Honorable Mbeli, and then Honorable Mulabatsi. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. No, certainly the presentation from the drafting team today reflects some good progress in incorporating the inputs that were made. So it's quite substantive improvements. Two questions I have is that in terms of the proposal to remove clause 26, sub clause 1, I'm just wondering if we might not potentially be creating a lacuna there, Because in looking at the Criminal Matters Amendment Act that's referred to, and I see that there was almost a literal copy and paste from that to here, but that act is specific, as the Brigadier said, it's about essential infrastructure, which is then defined to refer to the fact that it's about the provision and distribution of a basic service. But there might be instances where a critical infrastructure is not an essential infrastructure. And so that's a bit of a loophole for where if somebody does commit the offences stated in the bill now, would not be covered by the Criminal Matters Amendment Act. So it seems to me there might still be grounds for retaining that subclause 1 under clause 26, just to prevent that gap. So maybe if I can be assuaged as to whether there's a way to cover that. And then secondly, just to clarify on the proposal to reduce the maximum penalty. So is that to say that in subclause 3, 2 and 3, that both those 20 years and the 10 years maximum penalty ceiling will both be brought down to 3 years? Is that what I understood correctly?
Thank you, Jefferson. In your insertion of a clause about maximum offences, maximum penalties, are we likely to end up in a situation where you have a stipulation of saying maximum penalty 20 years? Can that be the case? My second question is, I see your document is quiet on risk categories, which was some of the concerns of the presenters, that the risk categories were not clearly defined. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Bachi. Any other member? Thank you, Honourable Members. To the drafting team, Brigadier, thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I will kick off. I suppose my colleagues will jump in when necessary. With regards to the issue of the private security mandate and how they will act when, for instance, some offence is committed at critical infrastructure, it must be kept in mind that the Criminal Procedure Act does give powers of citizens arrest, and the provision is that when such a person is arrested, may be detained until they can hand over to the police, etc. So I do think that the law surrounding private security officers will allow them to, for instance, deploy what I hesitate to call defensive measures. I'm not a good policeman, I'm a lawyer, but to deploy defensive measures such as blocking or pushing people out of a situation, or then ultimately arrest. The law does allow for defense of property and also for self-defense of property, and then of course for the arrest and detention and handing over to the SAPS. The search provisions will definitely be circumscribed very carefully within the regulations, even more than is in the bill itself. With regards to the second question with the regulations, certainly I must agree with the Honourable Member that there could be loopholes in the sense that the Executive may overstep their powers. It's important to have legislation with enabling provisions that are very clear and very specific, which is the reason why the regulation clause may seem very long, but those are the very specific powers that are given and not anything else. The typical regulation that states the minister may may make regulations that are necessary for the implementation of the Act, in my personal view, is too wide, which is why the drafting team used the very specific regulations. But once again, it's in the hands of the committee to make a decision on that. The drafting team or the departments will not push a certain agenda here. It's definitely not on the agenda for us. Then, with regards to the Honourable Mhlongo, the issue of drones is a very contemporary problem which causes a lot of problems. The Civil Aviation Act and the regulations issued there under regulates drones. Whenever such a drone encroaches upon the precinct, for instance, of critical infrastructure, the bill will kick in, and the typical taking of photographs will then become the offence. It is sometimes difficult to catch the offenders themselves, as some of these drones are very powerful and can be handled from quite some distance, but I think this will just require some good, honest police work to find those offenders and charge them under the bill and make sure that the intention of the person, whether it was to damage or to cause damage to the infrastructure, also be investigated very clearly. So that's an issue that also receives a lot of attention in the joint operational planning. For instance, for major events, the State of the Nation address, I think, is a very good example, where there's a joint planning with the Civil Aviation Authority in the operational rooms that makes provision for certain actions to be taken when there are drones that are flown illegally or unlawfully or possibly endangering the lives of participants in those major events.
Just to follow up on that response, thank you, Honourable Member.
When is a drone flown illegally? I mean, I've seen drones following marches, taking aerial shots, people playing with them in parks, etc. Is there an airspace above? There is. Okay, that's... Yes. Thank you.
Yes, Chair, there's a certain height that these drones may fly. They may not fly in certain areas or above areas where there are large concentrations of people. You can imagine that if that causes a panic and people starts, you know, there's a stampede, people may be injured, etc. So, but those are all covered in the civil aviation regulations. Chair, Honourable Mbele's question, the removal of clause 26.1, we did take into consideration that we may create a loophole, which is why the adaptation of the current clause 26.2 was made very clear that it concerns the security measures and then also with those further clauses that we will propose with regard to the intention to do some bad and also with the actual damage. The 26.1 in the Criminal Matters Amendment Act is actually a legislative version of the old crime of sabotage that doesn't exist anymore. And we felt that let it be in that legislation. We don't specifically need sabotage here as we make provision for it in other clauses. With regards to the maximum penalty, yes, they will still be severe penalties, but those will only be if there is evidence in court of aggravating factors, if I can put it that way. So if there is actual harm done, yes, it goes up to 20 years if it is a high-risk critical infrastructure. So there are still harsh penalties, but it is proportional to the action and also proportional in relation to the risk category of the critical infrastructure. I think that also to some extent covers the question of the Honourable Molebatsi. The second question from the Honourable Member was the issue of the risk categories. We do propose, Chairperson, to insert a clause where at least these risk categories are explained a bit more, to say that the Minister must have regard, and if I may just have a look at my notes, to insert a clause approximately in the vein of the following: when considering the categorization of infrastructure, the Minister must have regard to the prescribed system of categorizing infrastructure in a low-risk, medium or high-risk category. So there will be a prescribed system. The reason why we don't want to put this in the bill is because risk classification is obviously a very dynamic situation, and things may change from year to year. I mean, a couple of years ago, we didn't even know about drones. It is now an actual threat in a security sense, under certain circumstances. Then the second factor that has to be taken into account is the probability of failure, disruption, or destruction of the infrastructure in question or threat thereof, and what the impact and consequence of that failure, disruption, or destruction of the infrastructure will be. So, Chair, if the Honourable Members can imagine a matrix in terms of which the probability of failure is set out against the horizontal axis of the impact of that failure, taking into account the various risk categories, I think there will be a very clear system that the Minister must implement to prescribe in a certain risk category. So I think it will also be fairly predictable to any person who wishes to apply. It will be fairly predictable to see I'm going to fall within the low, medium, or high risk category. Thank you.
Thank you, Brent. And if we could, Bell, anything to add? Thank you very much. Members, additional questions with regard to the presentation? None. Right, members, I just want to make sure everybody's got a copy of the Critical Infrastructure Bill, the one that was published, and then the researcher's document, 12th of February. Right. Now, members, if we can go to page 2 of the researcher's document, and what we're going to do, as I say, we're going to really, in general, discuss the issues. If there's a major consensus, you know, we will ask the drafters to do the necessary, but I mean, if there's big issues, of course, we will then ask for further clarification, maybe further information to allow members to study it and give members an opportunity. Now, members will remember at page 2, the one issue that was raised was the tagging issue. There was, I think, indications by Western Cape, and some of the members of the committee argued for the 76, although the state law advisers and I think the parliamentary advisers also indicated the reasons why it was classified as a section 75. Now, I just want to get an indication from honourable members. What is the views? Is there still the view that it should be 76 or 75? Is that still the position?
Yes, Chair. I heard the arguments, and we could see to a degree the perspective conveyed by the official from the State Law Advisor's Office, but we're still of the view that there should still be a substantive processing with provincial considerations as per a 76 bill. So that's still our position of contention. Yeah.
I think maybe because it's an important issue, because it also relates to how we process the bill, that maybe if Parliament, I know they're busy with a lot of things, but it's the new dawn that's arrived. So is it possible if they maybe can provide us with a legal opinion on that issue? I don't know whether it will already be available by tomorrow, but let's if it's possible on that specific issue, that they can, and then we can discuss it in more detail. Will that be fine?
That will be fine, Chairperson. Thank you.
Right. Okay. Yes.
Chair, I must say I was a bit concerned by the input at the time. when it said, well, this would mean, oh, well, everything could be tagged as a 76, and what's the point of having a 75? That's not relevant. The point is there are issues in the provinces affected that will this bill will have an impact upon. That's it. It's not our issue whether other bills are tagged in any other way. It was about this one particularly. So I'm very keen to hear. Thank you.
We should also take note of the fact that this declaration will be by the minister at the national level, and by the so it's actually birthed in the national sphere. But I mean, we heard the colleagues, so we'll get that opinion and then discuss it. Is that fine? Thank you very much, colleagues. The second issue on page 2 there is the long title. The issue was raised that the long title should state that the measures referred to are in the public interest, and the response by the department was that it's adequately captured in clause 2E. Now, if we can go to clause 2E. It indicates that to secure critical infrastructure in the Republic by creating an environment in which public safety, public confidence and basic public service are promoted, Roman 1, through the implementation of measures aimed at securing critical infrastructure, and 2, by mitigating risks to critical infrastructure through assessment of vulnerabilities and the implementation of appropriate measures. Now, members, what is the view? Is there agreement that it's adequately included in the long title? Is that fine? There are no major issues. So we can... Thanks. Then the preamble. There was a view forwarded that the preamble should refer to rights that are affected. And I think there was a relatively long discussion indicated by the department that the Constitution already guarantees their rights. Are its members, happy with that? Right. Then the first issue was the definition issue. The concept of basic public services is too broad. The submission was that that it could include schools, universities and hospitals. And then in the second submission on 6 February, APCOF are here today, requested that the definition should expressly exclude bases from which basic public services such as medical clinics, schools and universities are accessed. The response by the department was that clause 16.2 limits the declaration of infrastructure to instances where the loss, damage, unlawful disruption of such infrastructure may severely prejudice the provision of basic public services. And then there's an internal limiter in clause 16.2. Members, on that one, is there general agreement with the input from the department? Okay. But as I said, in the terms of the process, when we go clause to clause, members is again welcome. We just want to get the issues that is really not agreement on. Then one, the CIP bill does not provide a clear definition of precisely what critical infrastructure is. And let's go to the definition in section 24. The minister may A, declare an infrastructure as critical infrastructure after considering, one, the application, the factors referred to in section 16.2 and 17, the recommendation of the Critical Infrastructure Council, and any other information which the minister deems appropriate, categorize a critical infrastructure that is declared in terms of paragraph A in either low risk, medium risk or high risk category, as may be prescribed, and C, imposes such conditions as may be prescribed regarding any steps and measures the persons in control of the critical infrastructure must implement to safeguard the critical infrastructure in question. Now, the response from the department was that the bill makes it clear that critical infrastructure is only infrastructure that has been declared as such by the minister. Members, discussion on that issue. They're very strong views on that. Yeah, you're welcome, Honourable Colabonot. You're welcome.
And the exclusion of the link to the cyber security legislation in terms of infrastructure. But I seem to recall you had already considered that and you were going to put some an amendment in. Am I not? It says specifically, okay, details infrastructure, building pipelines, it goes through all of it, government enterprises, etc. But it excludes information infrastructure as defined in the cybersecurity legislation. So there is that link that perhaps needs to be referred to there. And also, you also corrected, I think, the Republic, calling it the Republic of South Africa was just a little technical thing.
Thank you very much, Honourable Colonel Barnard. We'll just give the drafting team opportunity to look at that and then give us a response.
Thanks. Yes, Chair, on this, the submission on the 6th of February, we felt that there is clarity that the critical infrastructure bill only deals with physical infrastructure. And in fact, we will, during the course of the clause-by-clause deliberations, also propose that certain words be taken out to strengthen that. There is no proposal at the moment that was drafted to exclude cyber or critical information infrastructure as such directly, as we felt that it was clear enough in the bill that we're only talking about physical infrastructure.
But I think when we go to, I mean, that draft will hopefully be provided to us long before we go into that discussions. But I think the issues raised by Honourable Colonel Barnard that we just also deal with that then. So we'll flag this one. Then the next one is delete the definition of critical infrastructure complex, and I think the argument from the department was that it refers to multiple critical infrastructure like the Durban Harbour, etc. Did you propose a different definition, or is that still the same?
No, still the same, Chairperson. I think the initial submission was that I think the presenter, with all due respect, possibly misunderstood the phrase critical infrastructure complex in that I got the impression that the meaning was that it would be buildings on the same premises belonging to the same person in control, whereas the idea with the critical infrastructure complex is obviously that there are different critical infrastructures in a certain premises that must be managed in a similar fashion.
Right. Right, we then take note of that. If there's no major issues, then the strategic installations are accountable or unaccounted for in the bill. Then the department indicated will be disappear and be taken into the CI process. Can you just maybe expand on that again for the members?
Yes, Chairperson, the Western Cape government referred to strategic installations. In a previous version of this bill, reference was made to strategic installations. Then the police adapted, in the meantime, the police adapted a system of national key points that were declared, and then they referred to government institutions as strategic installations. But it was just an internal reference. It had no legal meaning or standing. So when this bill becomes legislation, the concept of strategic installations, even internally within the police, will disappear, and we will only refer to critical infrastructure.
Thank you, Brigadier. Honourable Bailey, and then Honourable Kodavana. Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. See, the only concern I have around this notion of strategic installations, which is why it was useful that it was included in the previous draft, is that if it's only an internal policy framework or an internal reference in the SAPs that places it outside the ambit of this bill and the subsequent acts, and therefore there's a kind of unaccountable system in place where, you know, various provisions and restrictions are placed on certain infrastructure or certain facilities that might see us land up with a, call it, unofficial National Key Point Act regime, where, yes, the critical infrastructure which is subject to the provisions of the bill post its processing and refinements, but we might still end up with a situation where the SAPs kind of tell us, oh no, but that building, it's not critical infrastructure, but it is a strategic installation, and the provisions and the limitations on that are ABC, and then we're back to a situation of lack of transparency and accountability. So I'm just worried that there's no guarantee by not having it in here to subject it to the same rigors and the same requirements for transparency and for objectivity.
Thank you very much, Honourable Bailey. Honourable Kalabona.
Just looking at the reference to B2, there was a vagueness in terms of person in control of critical infrastructure or any other person. And there was a call to define that quite clearly, either being head of a government department or head of something. But any other person was a very vague. So that, I thought, was quite relevant.
Maybe I have a clarification on that term. Thank you.
Yes, Chairperson, the whole concept of strategic installations will disappear. It will be killed off permanently. It will not exist any further. It was simply because government departments were often not national key points. So it was just made easier within the police to distinguish between the two. But that system will disappear completely. There will be no, they will not continue with it. As soon as this bill comes into operation, it will disappear completely. With regards to the vagueness in the definition, we will make a proposal to the committee on that issue specifically, Chair, maybe we can discuss that when we come to the definition itself, because I think it is in the list of matters here.
Thank you. Members, apparently there is new tea. Now, I'm going to just allow 5 minutes for members to help themselves, because even if in the new dawn, the tea may disappear. So members must just maybe go and help themselves. Thank you.
Well, I mean, I work for the operational stuff, so it's fine. We discussed this beforehand, but I think it's just easier for